Hello everybody, very warm welcome to World News. It is now day 25 of Israel's war on the Gaza Strip, with the regime continuing to pound the territory from the air, land, and sea. Officials in Gaza say Israel has now dropped more than 18,000 tons of explosives on Gaza since the 7th of October. Attacks have so far claimed the lives of over 8,300 Palestinians. Another 21,000 have been injured. Nearly 3,500 children have been killed, and that is one child every 7 minutes. For comparison's sake, this figure is more than 10 times the number of children killed in the first year of the Russia-Ukraine war. The Al-Shifa hospital is currently home to thousands of displaced Gazans who have taken shelter there after Israeli airstrikes leveled their homes. And now the regime has threatened and told besieged territory's largest medical center to evacuate, but Palestinians insist they will not leave.
Al-Shifa is the best and safest place for us, so we came here. Now the Israelis say that they will hit Al-Shifa. Whether they do this or not, this is what is normal for us now. The threats do not frighten us. Let them launch airstrikes as much as they want.
We want to die at Al-Shifa, despite all the threats and difficulties. We won't leave Al-Shifa. Where should we go? It is all the same death. We kneel only to God. We thank God for everything. May God bless us with martyrdom. We all sacrifice for Al-Quds, us, our women, children, and the elderly. We are all sacrificed for Al-Quds.
Threats do not frighten the people of Gaza, because we're a strong people. We have been steadfast all of our lives. We were born drinking salty water, and will do so now that there is no water. But we're steadfast in this land. We're not moving. They can slaughter, kill, do whatever they want, and we will stay here. We're not leaving. They, Israelis, want to displace us. But they're the ones who should leave. They're the ones who occupied us.
There are people here from all over Gaza who lost their homes. They are homeless now. There is nothing left. If they hit Al-Shifa, so let it be. We won't live here even if we are cut to pieces. We pray that these days pass. All those in Al-Shifa and in Gaza sacrifice for the resistance. Victory is coming, God willing.
And now, we've been reporting for the past weeks as Gaza is suffering from dire humanitarian crisis under Israeli attacks. The situation, in the words of the International Committee of the Red Cross, is worsening by the hour amid the regime's complete blockade of the Strip. And a handful of aid trucks allowed into Gaza through the Rafah crossing at the Egyptian border are nowhere near enough, as attested to by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees.
The system in place to allow aid into Gaza is geared to fail unless there is political will to make the flow of supplies meaningful, matching the unprecedented humanitarian needs.
In his address to the UN Security Council, the UNRWA chief warned basic services are crumbling while medicine, food, water, and fuel are running out in Gaza. He added, nowhere is safe in Gaza from Israeli bombs, not even the south, where the regime has been pushing people to go. A UN commissioner said not even churches, mosques, hospitals, or UNRWA facilities sheltering the displaced have been spared. In conclusion, Lazzarini called on the UN Security Council to demand an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, which he described as a matter of life or death for millions. The Russian president blames U.S. and its allies for Israel's massacre of Palestinians in Gaza, as well as many other deadly conflicts throughout the world.
Behind the tragedy of the Palestinians and behind the massacre in the Middle East in general, behind the conflict in Ukraine, behind many other conflicts in the world, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and so on, are the ruling elites of the United States and their satellites. This is already obvious to everyone.
Putin was delivering this statement to a meeting of Russia's Security Council and heads of law enforcement agencies. The Russian president added American politicians are opposed to a ceasefire in Gaza.
They don't want lasting peace. They want constant chaos in the Middle East. Therefore, they do their best to discredit those countries that insist on an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, on stopping the bloodshed, and are ready to make a real contribution to resolving the crisis and not feeding like parasites on it.
Who denounced indiscriminate killing of Palestinians in Gaza as unjustified. He also called for the creation of a sovereign and independent Palestinian state. The Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations has called on the Security Council to take action and end Israel's atrocities against the Palestinian people.
Treat us as human beings with the respect we deserve. We are not subhuman beings. We are not from another planet. We are exactly like each and every one of you. We are humans, human beings. Treat us in this manner with respect we deserve. Show respect for our inherent dignity, not in words but in deeds, in action, in doing something to stop this crime against our people and our children and our women and our wounded and our sick. No one should justify our killing or find reasons to give more time to the killer. Up and say
the resolution that you adopt. Riyad Mansour was speaking in an emergency session of the Security Council on Israel's war on the Gaza Strip. He noted regime strikes on Gaza amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Jordanian UN envoy also spoke at the meeting and warned about the repercussions of Israel's war on Gaza.
The continuation of the raging Israeli war against Gaza and the ensuing humanitarian disaster threatens a spillover effect into the region. Here, we warn against this impact and its repercussions on the security and stability of the region and the whole world. Here, we call for a cessation of Israeli aggression on Syrian territory and a cessation on the Lebanese borders.
The Jordanian envoy urged the Security Council to hold Israel accountable and punish it for ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza. The Chinese ambassador also delivered a speech slamming the U.S. for vetoing a previous Security Council resolution on Gaza.
The U.S. representative knows the best exactly what the U.S. did in the Middle East. The U.S. representative should also know very clearly that it is the U.S. that has vetoed the draft resolutions of the Security Council on Palestine and Israel, and that led to the difficulty of the Council to play a constructive, responsible role.
Russia's UN envoy also blamed the U.S. for ignoring the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Vasily Nebenzia warned humanitarian catastrophe on a biblical scale is unfolding in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Iran's deputy foreign minister warns Israel against continued deadly war in the besieged Gaza Strip. Ali Bagheri Kani said, if the war expands, there will be nothing left of Israel. Speaking in a TV interview, he hailed Operation Al-Aqsa, a flood that was carried out by the Hamas resistance group against Israel on the 7th of October. Bagheri Kani described it as a manifestation of the resistance front's intelligence and foresight. The Iranian deputy foreign minister likened the operation to an irreparable earthquake that hit Israel's security and military apparatus. He also noted the U.S. is responsible for crimes committed by Israel due to its unwavering support for the regime. And Iran warns of prompt response to any threat or aggression. Iranian ambassador to the UN said that is Iran's inherent right under international law. Amir Said Iravani made the comments at the UN Security Council meeting on Syria. He said the illegal presence of U.S. forces in Syria is a source of insecurity in the country and has bolstered terror organizations both inside the Arab state and across the region. Iravani also strongly condemned the continuous Israeli attacks on Syrian territory. He said raids mostly target civilians and vital infrastructure and are a serious threat to peace and security of the region. A delegation that is from the National Security Committee of the Iranian Parliament meets with several bodies and institutions in Syria, as our correspondent reports.
Within Iranian Parliament's constant diplomatic efforts, a delegation from the National Security Committee of the Iran's Parliament met with the Syrian Parliament Speaker, the Ba'ath Party Associate Secretary, and Palestinian resistance factions.
Our meeting today was held in participation of representatives from Palestinian factions and a delegation from the National Security Committee in Iran's parliament. The latest field developments in the region, specifically in Gaza, were discussed.
The Iranian delegation confirmed that supporting Palestine is a profound strategic choice, and Iran will always support the resistance, emphasizing that Gaza is fighting for the nation and humanity.
We highly value the pivotal role of the Islamic Republic of Iran and affirm that our people, who are being slaughtered in Gaza, aspire to much greater action than what the Arab countries have undertaken, as they have been either incapable to act or complicit with the Zionist entity.
This message today conveys the firm solidarity of the Iranian people and the Islamic Republic of Iran with the Palestinian people's choices in resistance and the repulsion of the brutal aggression that targets schools and hospitals and kills children. Iran is practically rejecting Israeli aggression.
Mr. Hamouda Sabbagh, Speaker of the Syrian Parliament, confirmed that Palestine will always be Syria's guiding principle and central cause, while the Palestinian faction leaders expressed gratitude for Iran and Syria for their crucial role in defeating Israel and reiterated their unwavering loyalty for the resistance front. The legislative Iranian delegation meets with the Palestinian resistance in Damascus, sending a message to the world that the besieged people in Gaza are not alone, and they will have all necessary support to withstand and defeat the Israeli aggression. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
People from all walks of life continue pro-Palestine demonstrations throughout the world, demanding an end to Israeli bloodshed. Hundreds of children in Ladakh Union Territory of northern India thronged the streets condemning the regime's genocide and the killing of children in the besieged Gaza Strip. In the German capital Berlin, protesters waved the Palestinian flag, calling for an immediate end to Israeli onslaught against civilians in Gaza. In Canada, thousands flooded the streets of Toronto, demanding a halt to Western funding for Tel Aviv. They also called for an end to Israeli genocide in Gaza. Similar rallies were also held in other cities throughout the world, including in Madrid, Beirut, and Islamabad. Demonstrators say the Western governments are complicit in Israel's war crimes in the Gaza Strip. Now, pro-Palestine rallies have also been held almost on a daily basis since Israel started its onslaught on Gaza. Demonstrations are being held despite bans on such protests in several European countries.
For the third Saturday in a row, pro-Palestine demonstrators packing the streets of central London to condemn the UK government's unequivocal support for Israel.
Our government is cheering this on and it's supporting Israel to carry on with the massacre in Gaza. So we want to try and stop that.
I'm so ashamed of our government that they are sanctioning what I think is just collective murder. And it really, really has got to stop. It's awful.
They should be listening to the protesters and demanding that there's an immediate and complete ceasefire, that humanitarian aid is allowed through.
From Madrid to Milan and beyond, even in Germany, home to one of the largest Muslim communities in the EU, where such protests have been restricted over what was described as anti-Semitism concerns.
Despite government attempts to delegitimize it, support for Palestinians is on the rise, with hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets of central London today to raise awareness of what's happening in Gaza and to express solidarity with the Palestinians.
Public pressure seems to be working. London's Labour mayor has become the latest politician to call for a ceasefire, breaking ranks with his party's leader, Keir Starmer, who said Israel reserved the right to cut all supplies to Gaza. 250 high-ranking lawyers have written an open letter to the government urging it to stop arming Israel.
And they are paying the taxes to kill our brothers, so it's unfair. It's completely unfair.
It should stop. We want ceasefire. We want talking, negotiating, but giving Palestine what it deserves, having been bullied for 50, 60, 70 years.
As the war on Gaza rages on, there is no sign of the emotions letting up or the demands that so many here are making for their leaders to find a political solution to the crisis. Saeed Porizza, London.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. Staying in a forest during the night. And tonight my dream has come true. Actually, I have accompanied a professional nature traveling team which aims to get familiar with the fauna of the Caspian Hyrkanian forests of Gilan province. In particular, Iran's rare roe deer, known as Shuka. What makes this miniature deer so special is that upon feeling danger, it makes a sound similar to a dogs bark. So I have to go to bed early? Because tomorrow could be a very exciting day. This is my flashlight. And I zip up my sleeping bag. Uh-huh. Good night. Shuka roe deer, also known as the roe, is a species of deer living in Iran. Shuka roe deer is found in northern Iran, in the Caspian region. They are found in the Hyrkanian woodlands and agricultural lands of the Alborz Mountains, Golestan National Park, Jahannama Protected Area. What makes this miniature deer so special is that upon feeling danger, it makes a bizarre sound. Well, I woke up early in the morning. I had a great breakfast and I'm ready for long time hiking. The team members are also ready and seem to be very excited. Before I pack up, I'd better tell you that the place I am now is like a patch of paradise. Hyrkanian forests are actually one of the most important natural reserves of the world. So for Shuka, there is no place better than Hyrkanian forests. It's time to set off. I'm ready. Let's go. Always special. However, this forest is unique, and I just need to spot Shuka. Shukas are active both during nights and days. During summer, they live individually and have their own territory. And during winter, they make small groups. It's interesting to note that shukas have a strong sense of smell. They also have wonderful visual and auditory senses. And they are professional swimmers. In normal situations, they are very calm. But when they feel danger, they jump at great heights. And I'm eagerly waiting to hear their special sound. Oh my god! Their sound doesn't match their shape! Shh! What? Shh! Okay! I speak quietly, okay? It seems they have spotted a shuka. Oh god! Look at them! They are the same size as gazelles. The only difference is that shukas have a kind of hunch on their back, yes. They have short tails, and their hair is reddish brown in color and soft. However, in winter, their hair becomes gray. Oh, look! That one is their baby! Oh, the mother is caressing its baby. Oh, did you hear its sound? The sound doesn't match such a cute creature. Shukas have precious ecological values, and they are a great case study for scientists. And it's so good that these animals live in Hyrkanian Forest, which is a well-protected area for them.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us ponder on a wise aphorism from Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, the 11th infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Worship is not the quantity of prayer and fasting, it is how much you think of your God.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Avoiding Hidden Shirk. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. How many times have we thought about the secrets of obtaining salvation on the Day of Judgment? How many times have we wondered, only if I knew the right recipe and a formula to guarantee my salvation in the hereafter? I'm pretty sure all of us, every now and then, think about this. How is it that I can know that one secret that is going to help me have salvation in the hereafter? Well, guess what? There was a companion of the Holy Prophet who was also wondering about this, so he asked the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He said, "How could one obtain the salvation of the Day of Judgment?" The Prophet of Allah answered, "Salvation is that you should not try to deceive Allah, lest He should return your deception to you. For anyone who tries to cheat Allah will be cheated by Him, and He will take the faith away from him. In this case, man deceives his own self, and he does not know." The companion had a follow-up question from the Prophet of Allah after this beautiful exception of how to acquire and attain salvation. But to discuss that follow-up question, we have to take a short break, and we will be back to discuss that follow-up question and how Prophet of Allah answered it. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about avoiding hidden shirk. And one of the ways one can do polytheism and shirk is through showing off. We were discussing about this question that Prophet was asked about the salvation on the Day of Judgment by one of his companions. And there was a follow-up question that I promised you that we will discuss. When the Prophet was asked, how could one obtain the salvation on the Day of Judgment? He answered, "Salvation is that you should not try to deceive Allah." The follow-up question by the companion was, "How does a man try to deceive Allah?" The Prophet of Allah said, "A person performs what Allah has ordered him, but he is concerned about other than him. It is a form of hidden shirk. If you're performing an action that Allah has required from you, then why in the world would you care for anyone else?" Unfortunately, this is the case, and this is a trap many of us fall into. Allah has commanded us to pray, for example. We pray, well, great, thumbs up. You're going to get some good reward for it. But then, before we start praying, or while we are praying, or after we are praying, we want others to notice that too. This is that hidden shirk that gets us in trouble. And many of our good deeds, unfortunately, get wasted for that. If you're doing something for Allah's sake, stop worrying about what others would think about you. Seek for Allah's approval only. Do not be concerned with others. Do not think that, whether this person is going to praise what I'm doing or not. Is he noticing that I'm doing such a long kunut? Is he noticing that my prostration and sajda is so long? Do not let these thoughts creep into your mind. Reformation of mind is important for that. And avoiding hidden shirk is sometimes difficult, but very much doable.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Part 1.
I was born in 1935 into a Christian family in Palestine. I was forced to leave my homeland after the occupation of Palestine. I lived in Egypt and Lebanon for a while and eventually went to the U.S. I studied English literature and became a distinguished professor at one of the most prestigious U.S. universities. But the Six-Day War in 1967 reminded me again that I was the child of an occupied homeland and a fugitive. I asked myself why no one in the U.S. and the West paid attention to this brutal occupation. When I studied Western literature and history with this question in my mind, I realized that the West not only has no problems with Israel, but also loves Israel. My years of research in literary and historical texts led me to a theory that I proposed in Orientalism.
I was struck by the consistency and the coherence of pictures or representations of the East, or the Orient as I called it, in a lot of European culture, you know, say 19th century French paintings by Gérôme, for instance, or novelistic writing, say, in the work of people like Flaubert and Disraeli, say, and sort of scholarly writing by linguists and historians and anthropologists and sociologists. The consistency of the picture that emerged of something called the Orient, and this collective portrait of the Orient grew in the 19th century and became as consistent as it was. And I related it to and I think this was one of the things that was quite controversial. I related it to European power. I was saying, really, that there is no such thing as the Orient. The Orient is much more complicated, much more varied, much more heterogeneous, and above all, much more detailed than any of these grand generalizations about, well, we know that Orientals tend to think in certain ways. That, for example, one of the things I mentioned in the early part of the book was Lord Cromer, who'd say, the Oriental mind is different from ours. It is not capable of grasping Western logic. You know, an Egyptian, for example, cannot walk on the sidewalk, he would say. You know, he has to walk on the street. That's a function of the mind. And I was saying, all of that's absolute nonsense. You know, you can't make these generalizations and then pretend that they are factual or scientific generalizations. They are rooted in rule.
The other thing he wanted to show is that those forms of representation of the other, of the East, of the Orient, worked according to a set of oppositions.
ثم أن إدوارد سعيد تطور باتجاهين منذ الاستشراق. الاستشراق يتحدث عن كتلتين, شرق وغرب, جوهرين إذا بدي.
In every way, they were constructed as the complete opposite of one another, and in every case, the positive aspects were associated with the West, and the negative aspects were associated with the East.
The Orient, the mysterious East, a place of fantasy, imagination, desire. This Orient has been created by the West, by artists, thinkers, dreamers, and adventurers. It gives fantastic expression to some reality that Europeans either wanted to possess or feared. Fabulous names, Harun al-Rashid, Omar Khayyam, Shahrazad. Fabulous places, Samarkand, Arabia Felix, Jerusalem the Golden. The lure of Jerusalem is uniquely powerful. It evokes the idea of the fabulous Orient, but it is also of the deepest significance to Muslims, Jews, and Christians. Usually, the Arab is represented as the other, deviant or excessive, less trustworthy, less human. One important function of these images is, I believe, that they justify the use of Western power to seek control over the East and to possess its riches.
Say, for example, that the great Bar Hebraeus, he speaks of this famous Syriac scholar of the 13th century, he says the great Bar Hebraeus was a genius of no parallel to him, but of course that's because he is the son of a Hebrew, see, which is really a problem, meaning to say that if he were not a son of a Hebrew, if he were a son of an Arab, he would have given him a different status.
Orientalism was translated into 26 languages, sparking debates, and had many supporters and critics. The main reason why colonial effects remain in the colonies is that the Eastern countries do not have a proper knowledge of themselves, and everything they know as history are the texts and opinions of Western Orientalists.
You take the modern Arab intellectual now, or the Muslim intellectual in general, when they want to talk about their own history, because they haven't done their homework, at the very end of the day, they go and quote what Grunenbaum had said, what Brockelmann had said, what summarized it for them, and hence they are still interpreting their own history through the eyes and through the visions of the Orientalists mainly German.
Though at the time I wrote, for example, The Question of Palestine, there were no histories of Palestine. I mean, I had to reconstruct the history, partly. Well, I had to deconstruct the official history that one saw in the Western press and in Western scholarship.
Said noted that the making of knowledge for the purposes of re-describing or reconfiguring the history of Islamic civilization altogether is a very important subject because language matters. How you describe your own history matters. And hence these people, these Orientalists, they are configuring for us the history and the intellectual history of Islamic civilization, and hence we are dependent on them.
The Iranian Revolution in 1979 was significant in my view. It was not violent, and a relationship was formed between the people and the religious leaders during the revolution, which in my opinion had a new meaning for the West. But the American media showed the Iranian Revolution differently from what it really was, in line with the U.S. government's policies to show a violent image of Islam.
And eventually, the inheritor of Iran.
He defended the Islamic Revolution by critiquing the American media, how it dealt with it.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
The story of 1979 U.S. Embassy takeover in Tehran mobilized all Americans against Iran. But despite the heavy atmosphere against Iran in the United States, my opinion did not change at all. In my opinion, the story of the embassy was in fact the retaliation of the Iranian people on the U.S. for all the calamities that imperialism and colonialism had inflicted on them. And this had nothing to do with Islam. Although I was a Christian, I could not remain silent in the face of this inverted propagation of Islam. All of these issues led me to write the book Covering Islam in 1981, and in a subheading I wrote, How the Media and the Experts Determine How We See the Rest of the World. The main subject of the book was about the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. I explained there how the American media, even the biggest and most influential, tried to lead the American public opinion to hate Iranians by big lies. It seems the Iranian
Iranian students have the initiative. The next move is evidently up to the United States.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A Palestinian woman recounts her family's impossible efforts to escape the Zionist regime's airstrikes in northern Gaza after warnings to evacuate south. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Tasnim Auni and her sisters-in-law were cooking dinner on Friday, October 13th, when the Zionist regime planes dropped leaflets ordering 1.1 million residents of northern Gaza to evacuate south. The leaflets read, Gaza City now is a battlefield. In a whirlwind of panic, she and her extended family, who reside together in an asbestos-clad house in Gaza, hastily gathered their essential possessions, modest savings, and a few items of clothing. She told Middle East Eye, "As we departed, my children and I shed tears. It was that moment I realized that my home was the most precious thing I possessed, second only to my daughters." With more than 12 family members, including her disabled mother-in-law in her 60s, the challenge of fitting into a small car and setting it in motion remains a blur to Tasnim. She said, "My children were terrified as the thunderous bombardments continued. The journey southward unfolded as a nightmarish odyssey," according to the mother of three. Tens of thousands of displaced people filled the streets, most of which were marked by bomb craters. Many individuals were seen on donkey-drawn carts, laden with sacks of flour and gas cylinders. She said, "I witnessed a new mother cradling her infant with one hand and protecting her pregnant belly with the other, all while walking with her children. It was a haunting sight. Although the journey itself took a mere 15 minutes, the ceaseless fear made it seem like an agonizing passage of days." They sought shelter in their relative's apartment in Al-Zahra City in central Gaza, where the intensity of bombing was slightly less than in other areas. Since the Zionist regime cut off electricity, fuel, water, and humanitarian aid to Gaza, in the aftermath of the October 7 attack, Tasnim's husband, Ahmad, 35, and his brother had been making perilous trips into Gaza to buy fuel from a local petrol station. They needed this fuel to power a generator, which in turn allowed them to extract water from a nearby well. However, their supposed refuge turned out to be far from safe. On the morning of October 19th, panic once again gripped them as the Zionist regime launched an airstrike targeting two towers in Az-Zahra city. The 32-year-old Tasnim said, "My brother-in-law warned me that if Israel targeted one tower in the city, it would likely extend its attacks to all the towers. It's like a malignant cancer spreading rapidly." Around 7 p.m., the Zionist regime issued a warning to all residents in Az-Zahra to evacuate the area before launching an attack on other towns. In a frantic rush, they gathered their belongings, clothes and blankets. The real struggle began when they had to carry Tasnim's disabled mother-in-law down the stairs. Thousands of people crowded the streets, desperate to escape the impending danger. The civil defense authorities advised them to assemble near a government school, cautioning against congregating inside it to avoid a fate similar to that of Al-Ahli Hospital. They huddled against the school's walls, the streets aside from the unsettling barking of dogs, were eerily devoid of any signs of life or movement. Then the sky began to glow with a fiery red hue, and this was followed by an ear-splitting barrage of explosions. Tasnim said, "It was a sound that defied description, the loudest and most unbearable noise I had ever heard." Tasnim said this cycle repeated itself almost every 15 minutes, persisting from night until morning. Every 15 minutes, we were left in tears, crying out in fear and desperation, unable to comprehend the relentless bombing that was occurring just a few hundred meters away from us. We were on the streets with our children, and there was no shelter to seek refuge in. To make matters worse, at 3 a.m., the cold began to set in and we weren't dressed warmly, intensifying our suffering. That night was, without a doubt, the worst night of my life. No words can truly capture the horror we experienced. It was beyond description. The following morning, the extended family, miraculously having survived, faced a difficult choice: return to their home in Gaza or seek refuge in one of the schools run by the UN agency UNRWA, where hundreds of thousands of people already sheltered. They ultimately chose to return home. According to the UN's Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the hostilities have left more than 1.4 million Gazans displaced, including 640,000 sheltering in 150 UNRWA buildings across the Gaza Strip and 121,750 sheltering in hospitals, churches, and other public buildings, Tasnim said. "Nine of us managed to return by car, while the rest of our family had to walk approximately 10 kilometers, as there was no taxi available. Back in my house, we faced the harsh reality of having no electricity or water. I rely on my neighbor, who has a small well, to provide me with a limited amount of water. Unfortunately, the water is extremely salty, given the proximity of well to the sea. Tasnim said, finding potable water and adequate food has become a daily struggle. My cooking options are limited, typically to pasta and canned goods like lentils and beans, which are available at local groceries. I consider myself fortunate to have a gas cylinder for cooking, especially when I see my neighbors resorting to open fires to prepare their meals. The devastating toll of the bloodiest conflict so far, claiming 7,327 Palestinian lives, including 3,038 Gazan children, has left an indelible mark on the impoverished Gaza Strip, particularly on its young. Numerous reports have shed light on the deep trauma afflicting the children of Gaza. In 2021, the Euromed Monitor for Human Rights revealed that more than 90% of children in Gaza had experienced some form of post-traumatic stress disorder due to the repeated Israeli regime assaults on the region. According to Press TV, the Commissioner General of the United Nations Relief and Works Organization for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, has issued a warning about the dire conditions in Gaza since the Zionist regime launched its onslaught against the enclave early this month. Philip Lazzarini sounded the alarm recently, warning that Gaza is on brink of disaster, with the risk of diseases spreading in the absence of fuel aid. Lazzarini warned at a press conference in Beit al-Muqaddas, Gaza is on brink of a massive health hazard, as the risks of diseases are looming. A few days ago, I warned that we will not be able to continue our humanitarian operations if we do not get fuel supply. The Zionist regime has cut off the flow of water, food, medicine, and fuel to Gaza, in effect largely stopping hospitals from treating the wounded due to a lack of electricity for medical equipment since the start of the Zionist regime's onslaught. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The disconnect between political leaders and the general public in the collective West could not be starker when it comes to support for the Palestinian people. Despite Israel's war crimes unfolding before our very eyes, politicians in the UK, United States and Europe have continued to offer moral and practical support to the Zionist entity. These politicians have even tried to suppress solidarity with Gaza at a time when Israel is engaged in a genocide. We'll be discussing these developments after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
The cowardly Israeli army only hits from the sky because the jailer cannot face its prisoner. And Gaza still stands. Gaza has been constructed and deconstructed by Israel over the years as a laboratory of frictionless occupation, meaning people are hunted by Israeli-controlled machines that determine their right to life. Israel cuts off the water, fuel, and electricity from Gaza as a form of collective punishment condemned by the Geneva Conventions. Do you see this clarity, O wounded nation of ours? This is why we must resist. While Joe Biden and others launder the lies of the occupier and seek to beautify the image of murderers, Gaza still stands. Gaza has taught us all